Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, we get lots of ideas for shows, lots of requests over our Facebook page via email. One of the most persistent, and yet one of the most difficult to produce, it turns out, has been questions about the Fed, the Federal Reserve System. Lots of people don't like the Fed, many people don't understand the Fed, and many people simply suspect that the Fed is somehow nefarious, somehow too secret, somehow too powerful to be constitutional. So the title of this episode is the Fed constitutional? Well, I've got a couple of very interesting people to talk to today about it. One of them is a United States Senator. His name is Rand Paul. He's from our neighboring state of Kentucky, and he's among the most vocal critics of the Federal Reserve. I also have a professor from Carnegie Mellon University. His name is Alan Meltzer, and he's actually written a book on the history and the function of the Federal Reserve System. Let's start with our discussion with United States Senator Rand Paul.
Well, you know, the Constitution specifically says things about our money. It says that Congress has to be in charge of both, coining money or borrowing money. So I'm not sure it would be constitutional to give up that authority. The Supreme Court has ruled at various times that you're not allowed to give up constitutional authorities without changing the Constitution. So really, I think we're probably in defiance of the Constitution by having a paper currency that's not backed by gold or silver.
I see. Well, if the Fed is not going to control our money supply, if in fact we were to decide that it is not constitutional, how would you control the money supply? How should it be controlled?
Well, one way to keep government from spending money they don't have or basically debasing the currency or devaluing it by printing up more money is to have it backed by something. So once upon a time when gold backed the currency, if the government printed up too much of it, what happened is people would turn their dollars in or their paper dollars in and get gold. So even under a gold standard, you would have a paper currency that people would probably walk around with paper, not gold. But if they became worried that a government was printing up too much of the paper, they would turn their paper in for gold. And we did have a gold standard of some sort even up until 1971. It was a gold standard, though, where the only people that were allowed to turn in their dollars were foreigners, which didn't seem quite fair to a lot of us. And what happened in the 1960s, when we began the Great Society and were funding the Vietnam War, the government printed a lot of money. Foreigners became worried about the dollar, and they started turning in all their dollars. And in a space of about 5 or 6 years, we lost half of our gold overseas. And so that's when Nixon severed the gold link to the dollar in 1971. And there have still been many who have said that things have gotten worse since then. For about 20 years after that, or maybe 30 years, almost 30 years, the dollar was backed by what they call the full faith and credit. And people kind of believed in it because ours was more stable than the rest of the world. But the interesting thing, in the crisis of 2008, the dollar now is backed by the things that the Federal Reserve buys, and the Federal Reserve bought toxic assets, which would be bad home loans and bad car loans. So I always joke that we were once upon a time had a dollar backed by gold. It's now backed by toxic assets, car loans, bad car loans, and bad home loans.
It sounds like your primary concern, Senator, is inflation. Is that correct?
Yeah, and we get it. Even when we're not at rampant inflation, even when it's not, 20% inflation, let's say it's 5 or 10%, and it depends on how you measure it, you have to realize when you look at that, that someone is having their savings stolen or their wealth stolen. And the people who get hurt worse by inflation, and the reason we print up money is to pay for debt. So debt is really the primary cause of this. A government runs a debt, spends more money to pay for it. But the people who get hurt are the working class who don't have enough extra income to be able to counteract the rising prices, and those on fixed income, those on Social Security, those who are dependent completely on their Social Security check. The lower income workers are the ones that get their wealth taken more quickly, and they have less ability to sort of adapt to rising prices. So right now the government's saying, oh, we don't have much inflation. But go interview a senior citizen in your area. Go interview a working class person who's trying to pay their rent. They'll tell you food prices are going up and they're paying more of their income for food. They'll tell you, and statistics don't lie, gas prices have doubled in the last year or two. So people who are struggling to get by are already being hurt by inflation. The inflation comes from debt, and that's why the working class and the senior citizens who have often voted for big spending Democrats need to understand that if they vote for people who are bringing on this debt, that's why their prices are rising. They are connected.
Well, I'm sure, as you know, both food and energy prices are notoriously volatile, and, you know, they go up and they go down. But I've heard Ben Bernanke, of course, who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, has said that his primary concern, at least over the last year or two, was rather deflation rather than inflation. And that's how I believe the Fed has justified increasing the money supply as much as it has done so. Do you have any reaction to that?
You know, it's a confusing issue. All I can tell you is that when you look at prices of food and gas, they've gone up pretty dramatically and continue to go up. If you look at the prices of homes from 2001 to 2007, you had enormous inflation. Some of the prices of homes actually tripled in value. I had people in my neighborhood who would buy a house, live in it for 3 months, sell it, move to another house, more expensive, buy it, sell it. I had one guy move back into the same house in my neighborhood twice and resell it. So that was sort of an illusion of wealth. I don't think the houses were becoming more valuable, but the paper currency was becoming less valuable, and it was being represented more in housing than anything else, because housing prices and housing booms are greatly dependent on interest rates, and the Federal Reserve was keeping the interest rates near zero and spawning this boom, and people got rich during it. But then people are now becoming very poor in the bust part of this cycle. So I think there's deflation in the sense that boom, with the correction of the boom, is falling prices. And the falling prices were in homes, but you have a mixture then. So you have rising prices in food, rising prices in gas, and falling home values. And banks that are, that became bankrupt because they had all these bad home loans.
And you believe that was primarily the result of the low interest rate policy of the Fed?
Yeah, and you don't get a boom like that without bad Fed policy, and you also don't get the bust. Now, I think an economy does have a certain cyclical nature to it. We do have an economy that sometimes gets to growing and sometimes becomes contracting. But you don't get these wild booms unless something is pervasive, something is throughout the whole economy, and it has to be some kind of bad information. And I tell people, you know, I'm a physician, I tell people that I think interest rates are a little bit like insulin. When you eat a big meal, your blood sugar rises, and then your insulin catches up, and it brings your blood sugar back down. When an economy has had a big meal, an economy is growing rapidly, what happens is more competition for the money. The marketplace would then say interest rates will rise because more people are demanding loans. But the Federal Reserve didn't ever let interest rates rise for like a 5 or 6 year period from 2001 to 2007. They kept interest, and they still have interest rates very, very low, probably below what the market would dictate. And when they do that, they spur an artificial boom. But we didn't get any signal. So if the interest rates would have risen, what would have happened is the economy would have slowed down a little bit. There probably would have been maybe a recession, but there wouldn't have been a dramatic crisis and crash like what happened in 2008. Yeah, and I do. I blame that fully and squarely on the Federal Reserve and bad policy. And I think it is important to know where to blame, because if you think that was a failure of capitalism, then the answer is more regulations. And that's what the liberals have brought us, is more regulations. But I think they misdiagnosed the problem. I think the problem really was government banks and bad government money policy.
Well, would you then favor an abolition of the Fed and a return to a free market system where interest rates are simply allowed to be determined by the market?
Yes, and I think we have to work to get towards that. I think, you know, one of the first steps we ought to do is find out what the Fed is doing, and that's having transparency and auditing the Fed. And my father had a bill that actually had 340 co-sponsors. Every Republican and I think nearly 100 Democrats sponsored this. And then they got it over to the Senate. We had about 37 co-sponsors, and they passed a watered-down version. So we did get a one-time audit, but really what we need is an annual or a biannual audit of the Federal Reserve, so we know what they're doing. And I think the fact that some individual bankers become very wealthy because of Fed policy and because of knowledge that the rest of us don't know is another reason why we need to be very careful about letting the Federal Reserve operate in secret.
What is the status of that effort? I mean, is there any hope that that sort of auditing is going to be passed?
We're trying again, and we haven't had as many co-sponsors this time around, and we will try, and we will try to add it on to any banking bills that come forward to see if we can get another vote on it. But I think there's becoming more of a consensus problem at the Fed. There are many mainstream conservatives who are now saying, well, gosh, the Fed really should be involved just with keeping the value of the money, not with value of money and unemployment. Because when you have those two mandates, they get a little confused on what they're supposed to be doing, and they think devaluing the money will actually help with jobs. So, yeah, there is more movement out there. There's not enough people to say, oh, let's get rid of the Fed, but there are more people talking about the problems the Fed creates, and I think there is enough of a movement that we can move in the direction of at least trying to reform it and maybe limit some of its powers.
Well, let me play devil's advocate and cite Ben Bernanke's reaction to calls for audits. I think he had a specific objection that if what we allowed auditing, especially of the monetary policy of the Fed, that it might cause a lack of confidence in those banks that had approached the Fed for assistance. And he was very concerned about that specific issue of confidentiality with certain banks. And I think more generally, and this is me paraphrasing arguments I've heard generally, there's a concern that if there's a very specific audit of the Fed and all of its deliberations, that will suggest too much political control over what some people feel should be the province of technocrats and bankers. How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, you know, most of the ideas for auditing the Fed usually are after the fact, so they don't happen immediately that day or even that week. So it does. I think most of the time it's at the year end, so I don't think it would change or influence their policy. And I think it specifically says within the audit bill that it is in no way meant to do that. So I think there are some arguments against that. I don't think he's necessarily an unbiased observer, but obviously someone who's supportive of the Fed and all the Fed does. But the other argument is to look at what's been going on and look at the boom and bust cycle that we've had for generations now and how that impoverishes and hurts people. So I think there's definitely an argument for what we've been doing has not been the correct thing and that we need to consider some other alternatives.
Well, I know that you've been critical of the Fed's role in creating the real estate bubble. How do you feel about what the Fed's done since the financial crisis began? And do you feel that their policies have helped or hurt?
Well, you know, there's a funny YouTube video that Fred Thompson did about a year ago, and he's chewing on a cigar, and he says, well, we got in this fix because they made interest rates too low and had it too easy. So let's see, how are we going to get out of this? Well, let's make interest rates even lower and credit even easier. So, yeah, I don't think we've the Fed or any of these people who promote the central bank have really figured out the problem. I think they're doing more of the same. We have incredibly low interest rates. They've tried to actually have them below zero. But it's sort of, trying to, squeeze something that isn't really there, trying to get something out of the economy that probably doesn't exist. The only way we begin to grow again as a country, the only way the housing market recovers, you have to do what they call deplete your inventory. You have to sell all the existing homes, and then you will begin to build new ones. But until the existing homes are sold, you don't. What does that mean? It means houses have to find a low. So if there's still houses out there not being sold, it means that the price of homes has not found its bottom. When it finds its bottom, all the houses are sold. There is a price at which every house in America will be bought. And so when you have too many houses, the price has to fall, and it has fallen. But the reason it hasn't found its bottom yet is the Federal Reserve owns a lot of these. They own a lot of the loans. And so if they're not being negotiated, the price is not allowed to fall. In my neighborhood, there are 10 houses not selling. You know, I ride my bike around the neighborhood next to me, and I see another 10 houses not selling. You got to sell those houses, and it's punishment for the owners to have the price fall. But the interesting thing is that new people, young people coming up trying to buy their first house, if a house costs $150,000, 5 years ago and they can get it for $75,000, there is a bit of a boon for the next person in line. It hurts the person trying to get out from under the debt, but sometimes that means bankruptcy, sale of the house at a lower price, but then maybe the guy just out of college trying to get ahead can afford a $75,000 house and is able to get into it.
Hmm. Well, as you know, Bernanke and his supporters claim that they have averted another Great Depression by having a very expansionist monetary policy right now. And in fact, they even cite Milton Friedman, an economist who by and large might even agree with you. I think Milton Friedman was a critic of the existence of the Fed. But even Milton Friedman said that one of the major mistakes the Fed had made back in 1929 was contracting the money supply after the crash of the stock market that year. So how do you respond to that? I mean, you know, given that they'd already screwed up, according to you, and created this bubble, didn't they have to adopt an expansionary monetary policy just to avoid a Great Depression?
Well, I think it's easy for them to pat themselves on the back and say, oh, it would have been much worse had we not done this. But nobody knows the alternative futures of what would have happened. Some have said, well, we would have had a deeper recession, but we would already be climbing out of it now. So I think it's easy to say, well, you know, it would have been worse. But these are also the same people that in 2006 and 2007 were saying there was no end to the boom, the housing, you know, there was no threat to housing. So they've told us a lot of things that haven't been correct. They didn't predict it. I think they caused it. So really, I have no reason to believe their alternative version of what the future would be.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're discussing whether the Federal Reserve, the Fed, is in fact constitutional or not. We've been talking with one of the Fed's most persistent and vocal critics, United States Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. In just a minute, we'll be talking to another fellow who's also very critical of the Fed, but who has a different opinion on its constitutionality. But before we do that, let's have our Madison Minute.
The first National Thanksgiving Day, November 26, 1789, was so designated by a proclamation by President George Washington and a congressional resolution. Why? To give thanks for, among other things, the new Constitution. When the Constitution was signed, roughly 4 million people lived in the United States. Today, the U.S. population is more than 311 million. Then, Philadelphia was the nation's largest city, with 40,000 inhabitants, about the size of present-day Charlottesville, Virginia. The U.S. Constitution was ratified by the people through a series of state-by-state conventions instead of an existing legislative body. To persuade the people to vote for the new Constitution, James Madison, along with John Jay and Alexander Hamilton, anonymously authored The Federalist, a series of newspaper articles that today constitute one of the most important sources of constitutional interpretation. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're discussing the constitutionality of the Federal Reserve. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk to Professor Alan Meltzer of Carnegie Mellon University. Stay tuned. Well, everyone loves a quiz, and everyone loves Kelly, and Kelly is here, our quiz lady, to give us a quiz, so what could be better? Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Doing extremely well. Now, who do we have on the line for our quiz today?
Mitchell.
Mitchell, where are you from, Mitchell?
Glenville, West Virginia.
Glenville, West Virginia. Well, we're so happy to have you with us. And Kelly, do you have a hard question for Mitchell today?
I have a Second Amendment question for you, Mitchell.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Do you know what the Second Amendment's about, Mitchell?
Yeah, I'll give it my best shot.
Okay. Well, we'll just see what the question is. What do you got, Kelly?
All right. According to the wording of the Second Amendment, the purpose of the people's right to keep and bear arms is A, was not given, it must be inferred from the historical context. B, was so that a well-regulated militia could be maintained. C, was so that people could be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Or D was so that Western frontiersmen could provide themselves with a basic subsistence through hunting.
Okay, so the Second Amendment has something to do with gun rights.
Yes.
But our question goes to its rationale, right?
Exactly.
Why do we have a Second Amendment? So what were the choices again?
Sure. The purpose of the people's right to keep and bear arms, which is in the Second Amendment, is it A, was not given. It must be inferred from the historical context.
What do you think of that one? What do you think of that one, Mitchell? Was it something that wasn't given? I mean,
it was given, but I'm thinking the Supreme Court decisions in my answer here, so I'm trying to think. But I mean, it was given, but I'm not sure that's the answer choice I'm going to choose.
Okay, so we're not going to choose A, which was that there's no reason given. Okay, so we're not going to choose that for now. What was B, Kelly?
B was so that a well-regulated militia could be maintained.
Did the Second Amendment say that that's the reason we have a right to keep and bear arms? Mitchell?
I don't believe so, no.
No, okay, so you don't like B either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, then let's go on to C. What's C, Kelly?
C was so that people could be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects.
That sounds like a good thing. That sounds very constitutional, in fact. What do you think about that one, Mitchell?
I'm leaning towards that one because that sounds really familiar.
Persons, papers, and effects. Securing the... Okay, all right. That sounds like a good answer, but let's go and see what D is.
D was so that Western frontiersmen could provide themselves with a basic subsistence through hunting.
Well,
no.
You don't think
no.
so? No. There's no hunting in the Second Amendment?
Oh. A lot of people would say that there's hunting in the Second
Amendment.
I don't think
they need a constitutional amendment to hunt and feed themselves.
I see. All right. Well, then what answer choice do you like?
I'm going to go with C.
C, and C was once again...
C was so that people could be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects.
Okay. Is that your final answer, Mitchell?
Yeah, we'll go with that.
C is Mitchell's final answer. Kelly?
Oh, Mitchell is so close, but actually, if you go to the language of the Constitution, B is the correct answer, was so that a well-regulated militia could be maintained.
Yeah.
And I see Stuart has his Constitution in front of him right now.
Yeah. This is what we call a textual question. You know, the question was looking for what's actually written in there. And as you pointed out, Mitchell, you know, the Supreme Court subsequently can interpret, you know, various provisions of the Constitution in different ways, and sometimes that's actually in the text and sometimes it's not. But in this case, we're looking for the text, and the Second Amendment actually begins, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And then it goes on to say, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So there was a rationale given in the actual text of the amendment, and how important that is, of course, is for the courts to decide. But sorry about that, Mitchell.
No problem.
All right, but thank you very much for playing. Unless Kelly wants to.
Oh, should we do it?
You're the one who's always grinning at this point.
Kelly, all right, Mitchell, here's your redemption. If you could tell us what the Third Amendment is to the Constitution, you can redeem yourself and get your own, your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
This is your second chance, Mitchell. What does the Third Amendment say?
It is the most important amendment.
It's Kelly's favorite amendment. Mitchell?
He ran for the hills again.
He's running for the hills.
No, didn't run for the hills. I just totally just drew a blank.
Well, okay, Mitchell. We're just going to have to...
No.
Oh, sorry about that. But, hey, look, at least you're going to get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. And, Kelly, you get to tell us, what does the Third Amendment say?
No quartering of troops.
No redcoats in my house.
No redcoats in my house.
All righty. Well, Mitchell, best of luck next time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we're talking about whether the Federal Reserve, is constitutional or not. Before the break, we had the pleasure of speaking to United States Senator Rand Paul, one of the Fed's most persistent critics. Now we're going to talk to another fellow who's also critical of the Fed, but who thinks it's actually quite constitutional. His name is Alan Meltzer. He is an economist and a professor of political economy at Carnegie Mellon University's Tepper School of Business in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You literally are the guy who wrote the book, The History of the Federal Reserve. So my first question is simply, what is the Federal Reserve?
It's our central bank. it's responsible for deciding on the amount of, on the level of interest rates that, you know, on short-term securities in the market, and in doing so, it sets the growth of money and credit.
Sets the growth of money and credit. Now, how, this sounds like an extremely important job. Could you explain exactly how it works? How does a central bank do what it does?
It buys and sells securities in the market. Usually, it buys and sells government bonds. Recently, it's been buying and selling mortgages and other things that are unusual for a central bank to do.
Yes, indeed it has. Now, I've heard it said that when the Federal Reserve buys something, it is with the stroke of a pen, or I guess these days the stroke of a key on a computer.
Key,
yes. Yeah, is actually creating money. Is that true?
It creates bank reserves, and the banks use those reserves to create money and credit.
I see. All right, well, this is, of course, a show about the Constitution. Is such an important institution part of our government? How does it fit into our constitutional scheme?
Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution gives Congress the right to coin money and regulate the value thereof. The Federal Reserve is the agent that they picked to do to carry out that responsibility.
And so has there ever been a serious challenge to the constitutionality of the Fed?
There have been challenges. I would hesitate to call them serious. I mean, Article 1, Section 8 is pretty clear that Congress has the right to coin money and regulate the value thereof, and it has certainly every right to delegate that responsibility as it chooses.
Well, you said the magic word, of course. There has been controversy over the course of the last 100 years or so about something called the non-delegation doctrine, and as I'm sure you know, it used to be the case that Congress would occasionally get in trouble constitutionally when it gave away too much power. But, of course, that has not been the circumstance for at least the last 70 years or so. So I guess, is it fair to say that it's not just a constitutional entity, but the Fed is clearly constitutional?
Well, I'm not the constitutional lawyer. You are. so I'll leave the definitive answer to that to you. I would say, though, that the people who are objecting to the unconstitutional grounds of the Fed are misdirecting their fire. The point that they should be emphasizing and doing much more about is the fact that the Federal Reserve, when it was started in 1913, 1914, in the Woodrow Wilson administration, was a body of limited responsibilities and authority. It's sort of a Madisonian type. It had clear and definite restrictions on what it could and could not do. And all those restrictions have virtually vanished now. So the issue, at least for me, is how do we rein in that power? It is, in my mind, not good in a democratic government to have such unlimited power in the hands of a board that is extra legal, that is legal, but without much direct control from the public.
Okay, so even though it's perhaps not a constitutional issue, you think it's a matter of policy that perhaps we've given too much power to too few people, and maybe they're going a little bit too far with it. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I would say we haven't given it to them; they've taken it.
Well, how did that happen? I mean, what were these restrictions that have been dropped along through the years?
Well, the first restriction was a very definite statement that they could not buy bonds or bills of any kind from the Treasury. Well, what they did by the 1920s, they were regularly buying and selling those bills as much as soon as a day after the Treasury sold them to the market. So they had circumvented the regulation.
The regulation said they couldn't buy them directly, so they simply went out and bought them a day later.
Indirectly, yeah.
Okay, I see.
But, you know, and now that's the principal way in which they regulate the banking and financial system. So that's a circumvention. Then, of course, we were on the gold standard when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, and that meant that they were limited in how much they could buy and how much they could hold at any particular time, because if they held or bought too much, the exchange rate against gold would go down, and the result would be that the Fed would have to step on the brake in order to protect its gold price. It doesn't have any restriction of that kind. I'm not an advocate of the gold standard. I've never been. As a matter of fact, I think the gold standard, we don't have the gold standard mainly because it isn't because we don't know about it. It's because we do.
Right.
We prefer to see something done about employment, and we worry much less about the exchange rate. And that's a democratic desire that's true in almost every country of the world, and it's especially noxious in our country because there are no limits on what the Federal Reserve can do.
I see. So the gold standard, even though you don't favor it, did present some limitation on effectively at least what the Fed could do when it intervened in the markets. So without those limitations, without the gold standard as an implicit limitation, without the restriction on the purchase of securities from the U.S. government, the Fed, then it sounds, can pretty much do what it wants to do. It can just create as much money as it wishes or contract the money supply as much as it wishes.
That's correct, and it's done both of those. So that if we look at the history of the Fed over 100 years, we find only two periods, quite remarkable, only two periods, neither of them terribly long, in which they produced relatively stable growth and low inflation. And those were the periods, interestingly enough, from 1923 to 28, when we were on a limited form of the gold standard. And then the period from 1985 to 2003, when they followed something called the Taylor Rule, which directed them to follow very precise limits on what they did. And that, those were the two best periods in Federal Reserve history. And so that tells us that despite many claims about the importance of discretion, the best periods in Federal Reserve history have occurred when they followed a restricted rule.
Very interesting. Now, there are lots of interesting concepts, in fact, in what you just said, but I'd like to talk about one of them. You mentioned the two basic goals, or at least what's commonly considered the two basic goals of the Fed.
Well,
and one
Congress designated those as goals in the 1970s.
Okay, and that's, of course, to increase employment on the one side, but to control inflation on the other. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and I've often heard it said that those two goals are in tension with one another. Could you explain a little bit about that, please?
Well, it is true that if you try to increase employment, you may again eventually get inflation because you're printing money in order to create better markets, lower interest rates, more money, and more credit. And then when you try to stop inflation, as we saw in the 1970s and 1980s, in the Volcker years, we ended up with an unemployment rate of 10.8%, the highest in the post-war period, even including this massive recession. So in that sense, people say there's a conflict between the two. But that conflict arises, as far as I'm concerned, because of the way in which the Federal Reserve conducts itself. It conducts itself by saying, well, we have a dual mandate, so we're going to proceed one leg at a time. We're going to try, as we are now, to increase employment, and then we'll stop doing that after the inflation rate gets high enough that people start to scream about it, and then we will do something about inflation, and that will increase unemployment, and so on back and forth. So we're putting in a lot of variability. Now, what they did from 1985 to 2003 that worked very well, they paid attention to both goals. That's the only time they did that, and we got a very good result.
And that was pursuant to what you referred to as the Taylor Rule, is that right?
The Taylor Rule, yes.
Without getting too technical, because remember, we're not all economists out here.
Sure.
What exactly was the Taylor Rule? Why was it so effective?
The Taylor Rule directs the Fed with specific weights on unemployment and inflation. That is, it takes seriously the so-called dual mandate that Congress gave the Fed, puts weights on them and says, follow that as a policy. Change the interest rate when either of those changes, and if they both change, change the interest rate as directed by the changes that occurred.
Hmm. And why did they abandon this rule if it had worked so well for so long?
Well, because they felt that there was a danger of deflation.
Okay, that was at the outset of this current financial crisis?
It was about 2004, 2005.
Oh, even earlier, okay.
Yes, and so they began to do something about what they thought was a problem of deflation. There was never, in my mind, a serious problem of deflation, and even if prices fell for a year at 1%, I mean, it's not a big deal. But the Fed panicked at that point, abandoned it, and made money easy, so it helped to finance the housing bubble.
Oh, that's very interesting. I've heard it said, of course, that if deflation is a terrible thing, because as soon as you start moving into negative territory, expectations are ratcheted down, and people will then stop buying things because then they're figuring that prices will be lower in the future, and so it will have a very rapid cascading effect. But apparently that's not a fear that you share?
Well, I certainly don't think we want a serious deflation, that is, a deflation of 3, 4, 5, 10% a year. But we're talking about a 1% deflation that's hardly noticeable and wouldn't have much effect on anybody any more than a 1% inflation has very much effect. I mean, the two are symmetric. In one case, people with bonds lose. That's the 1% inflation. And the other, people with fixed income or bonds gain. That's the 1% gain. But they don't gain much. They gain 1%.
So it's not really that big a difference if you've got...
Small amounts, it's not a big difference. That is to say, I don't advocate that. But if that were to occur, it's not a reason for panic.
All right. Well, then, I'm going to guess, then, that you would suggest that one solution to our current difficulties is a return to the Taylor rule?
Yes, indeed. Now, no rule. We live in a world of uncertainty. Uncertainty meaning very well defined by Secretary Rumsfeld is saying we have to worry about the unknown unknowns,
mm-hmm.
but we really don't know how to worry about them
mm-hmm.
because they are unknown unknowns. So the Taylor rule works very well on average and in most periods, but things like the housing bubble could throw us off. Now, we wouldn't get big bubbles if we didn't finance them with money growth.
I see.
We wouldn't avoid them probably completely, at least we don't know that we would. But we don't get bubbles if we don't produce a lot of money to finance them. After all, what's a bubble? People are buying some asset. They have to have some money and credit to buy that asset. If the Fed finances those assets, we get too much, we get a bubble.
I see. All right. Now, that's the policy response, but I'm also curious just about the institutional response. You're concerned that the Fed has too much discretion. You're concerned that it's not accountable, or maybe even that it responds too much to political pressure. What is the institutional fix for this so that we don't have to deal with this problem again and again?
We need to get an agreement on a rule. And doing that, like the Taylor rule, but there are other rules that we could have in any rule would be better than complete discretion because it would tell people what to expect.
Okay, and so you'd actually write that into the law because if I understood you correctly, this Taylor rule is simply a policy decision that the Fed's...
Right, and okay. I would like to see Congress approve a rule.
Very interesting, and a very important thing constitutionally because, the idea of Congress delegating a lot of its power is only constitutionally sound if Congress gives a guiding principle to the agency in question, and perhaps
that's what
you're talking about, is Congress stepping up and giving the Fed a little bit more direction, which would be both better from a policy perspective and better from a constitutional perspective, perhaps.
Absolutely. And why don't they do that? The answer, I believe, is that they're motivated by very short-term concerns, and the Fed is motivated by very short-term concerns. Some of which it gets from the bankers and the financial markets, some of which it gets from Congress. So they respond very quickly to things like unemployment. If it were to rise, and there would be a lot of talk, as there was in, say, the summer of 2010 in the marketplace, that maybe we're going to have another recession and maybe there was going to be deflation and they pressured the Federal Reserve into doing what, into expanding more.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking to Professor Alan Meltzer of Carnegie Mellon University, who is talking to us about the constitutionality and the policies of the Federal Reserve. After the break, we'll have our discussion of this week at Montpelier, and then we'll talk some more with Professor Alan Meltzer. Stay tuned.
When you have big state government, small federal government, our voices are heard at the local level. We can make differences. A whole continent wide cannot control a federal government with a banking system that prints money like it's paper. You can't even call it money anymore. Gold is money. Silver is money. Green dollars are not money. They're using inflation as a hidden tax to fuck the people. Prices go up. Do your wages go up? No. My wages didn't go up, but prices went up. And this is all because our government prints too much money, starts too much wars, so they can sell their tanks, their guns, their missiles. Because that's all America exports, is guns, missiles, and tanks. That's it. We need to bring production back to America. And the Federal Reserve. And the fractional banking system. 1913, this country died. When we adopted the central bank and we got rid of sound money, we used to be able in 1913 to walk into a bank and redeem our dollars with gold. Can we do that anymore? No. What's the price of gold now? Almost $2,000. It's gone up $600 an ounce this year.
It's going to keep rising.
And it's going to keep rising as long as we have bailouts, as long as we have quantitative easing, as long as our government keep spending our money.
Money, get away, get a good job with more pay and you're okay. Money, it's a gas, grab that cash with both hands and make a stash.
I'm feeling curious. I just wonder what's happening this week at Montpelier. Can you tell me, Kelly?
I think you're going to be surprised to hear this. Mud camp comes to Montpelier.
Mud camp?
Mud camp.
What is
yes,
mud camp?
This is becoming such a fun tradition at Montpelier. Summer's almost out for the students, a week of June 2nd, and Montpelier is getting ready to welcome its rising 3rd through 6th graders for our annual mud camp. And each day, and it really earns its name, mud, because kids come to Montpelier each day to get muddy, taking hikes, wading through streams, and playing outdoor games. And during the sessions are June 18th to the 22nd for the rising 5th and 6th graders. I'm sorry, for the rising 3rd and 4th graders.
Mm-hmm.
And the rising 5th and 6th graders are June 25th to the 29th. And it's a great way to come and learn about nature and all the different things that are going on in Montpelier.
Oh, man, my kids would have absolutely loved that. The very concept of just going out specifically to get muddy, they would have jumped at that.
Oh, it's amazing to watch these two at the end of the day. Some of our Montpelier colleagues will have their younger children go through mud camp, and at the end of the day, they come into the offices. Well, they're not allowed in the offices.
Of course
actually,
not, right.
They're actually kept outside, and they're from head to toe. I just, you know, these kids have a lot of fun.
And I'm betting, and I'm speaking to the parents now, this would be a wonderful way to really tire out your children, and I bet when they come home,
they're exhausted.
They are ready for bed.
Absolutely exhausted.
Well, not that we'd ever want to tire our children out, but if it's occurring to anybody, okay. So where can we go for more information?
Montpelier.org. You can learn about the two different sessions. And again, it's fourth graders June 18th to the 22nd and fifth and sixth graders June 25th to the 29th.
Montpelier.org. Thanks, Kelly Carmichael.
Thank you.
Okay. It's your weekly Constitutional. Now let's go and finish our discussion with Professor Alan Meltzer about whether the Federal Reserve is constitutional and whether it's doing the right thing for the United States economy.
One of the striking things that I learned from reading the minutes or transcripts of the Federal Reserve, and I've read more transcripts of the Federal Reserve than any living person ever ought to read. They're not exactly good bedtime reading, unless you're planning to go to sleep.
Yeah, they might be perfect bedtime reading. Sounds like they might put you out.
One of the striking things about them is that, with very minor exceptions, there is no discussion in those transcripts which says, if we do this today, where will we be a year from now? Where will we be 2 years from now? But that's the time frame within which their policy affects the rest of us. They're very concentrated on what's going to happen next month or next quarter, and that's something over which they have very little control. And that's one of the main reasons, not the only one, why we get periodic problems.
Well, Dr. Meltzer, that's fascinating, and I'm sort of laughing at myself. We've talked for several minutes now, just basically my first question, you know, which was, you know, what is the Fed and how does it work and what's it doing right and wrong? But actually, I'm curious also, since you've written a book on the history of the Federal Reserve, can we actually take a little step back a little bit, and could you give us, in a nutshell, why the Federal Reserve was formed and how it came about?
Well, we had, as many people know from learning history, we had the war between Andrew Jackson and the Bank of the United States back in the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackson won the war and got rid of the bank. So after that, we didn't have a central bank. We were more or less, most of the time, except during war, were on the gold standard. And de facto, by law, we were on the gold standard after the late 19th century. We had a lot of crises. Bank runs, interest rates up to overnight rates up to 100%. And we didn't have a very definite mechanism for dealing with those problems. So there was general agreement that we needed to do something. And the main motivation was really something quite different. We were a big agricultural exporter. Wheat, cotton, big exports at the turn of the century and before World War One and after.
Mm-hmm.
The farmers financed those, much of their exports to Europe. The principal buyers of our grain and cotton were England and the continent. Those were financed by British banks. They had an advantage because they had a central bank, and if they lent money more than they were able to lend, they could discount, that is, borrow from the central bank against good paper.
Mm-hmm.
The New York bankers wanted that business. So they were very anxious to have a central bank which would permit them to borrow. The farmers, the merchants, mostly were voting Democratic at the time, they wanted competition in the market for lending. So everybody agreed we needed a central bank to lend to bankers who would lend to farmers and move the credit, move the cotton and wheat crops and others to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the main motivation. We were on the gold standard at the time, so we created this institution of very limited responsibility. And because the gold standard ended and because they circumvented the provision that said they could not buy and sell government bonds, we ended up, after the Great Depression and increasingly over time, the financing of wars, we ended up with an agency that has no practical limits at all.
I see. That's interesting. Now, if I could put that in lay terms, then there were primarily two reasons to have a central bank again after Andrew Jackson killed it in the 1830s, and one was simply to promote economic stability,
and growth.
And the second one was to promote growth by effectively, well, as the name says, to serve as a reserve, a place where private banks could go when they needed to lend out more money than their own reserves would allow them to do at that time.
Yes, and that's a perfectly good thing, sensible thing. No problem with that at all. Problem is, we need limits on the amount of that could be done, and we need discipline to see that we don't get periodic inflation and unemployment to a greater extent than nature requires of us.
Understood. Now, there's a term that we've used several times in here, and it's a term all of us have heard, But I'm willing to bet that a vast majority of people have no idea what it really means, and that term is gold standard. Could you explain to us in the simplest way possible what exactly that means and why it was important, even though you don't favor it?
Yes, it's a rule that says to the central bank, that is to the country, when gold flows in, print money and lower interest rates. When gold flows out, reduce money and raise interest rates. So it's a rule which governs the behavior of the central bank. Now, the reason I have not in favor of it is very simple, because that's a rule which says the object of the central bank is to control the price of gold, to keep it fixed. Originally, for the United States, at the time of the Federal Reserve, $20.67 an ounce of gold. That later was the value, the dollar, in the 1934, in January 1934, and it became $35 an ounce of gold. Now, two reasons for opposing that. One is because that says if the price of gold changes, we have to reduce or increase money. And that has effects on employment and prices in the country. And that's something we prefer not to occur, to have occur.
Yeah, that's interesting. In fact, I've always thought of the gold standard in a way as you're making your whole economy hostage to a piece of metal. And
right.
it's not
the price of a piece of metal.
Right. It's not a finite supply. I mean, we're finding more gold every day, and gold, you know, we may find uses for gold which have an effect on its market price as well.
Sure.
And I mean, they're all, you know, so you've essentially designated almost arbitrarily, I guess for historical reasons, that this is going to be your ultimate store of value. And yeah, that seemed to me to be always the major argument against the gold standard, was that you're giving up control of your economy to this inert object.
Right. Now, in the 19th century, we were mainly an agricultural country.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 20th century, we were, for the most part, a manufacturing country. Well, so we had a lot of labor, not on farms, but in factories. And we didn't want, that is, as a nation, we didn't want to subvert their interests to the interests of the price of gold. We preferred to use our policy for the dual mandate, that is, unemployment and inflation. That meant we couldn't follow the gold standard. That's a democratic decision. It's a decision which is made in many countries. Now, many people, my old friend Ron Paul, are in favor of a return to the gold standard. But that would be a unilateral decision, and it would be, in my opinion, a really dumb decision. Mm-hmm. The reason it would be a dumb decision is easy to explain. Suppose there was, as happened last year, the tsunami and and its problems in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
If the Japanese then people decide to buy gold because they're frightened, we have to sell it. That means we have to deflate. We have to lower our prices, increase our unemployment in order to service them. That doesn't seem to be something that would be in any way in our interest.
So we've made ourselves not only hostage to the piece of gold, we've made ourselves hostage to the vicissitudes
Every
of the weather.
In the world.
Understood. I'm so glad you mentioned Congressman Paul, because we had the pleasure of interviewing his son, Senator Rand Paul, actually last December. It's been a while. I have had just a heck of a time getting anybody from the Fed to talk to me. I actually spoke to Senator Paul and anticipated that I could speak to people at the Fed, and tried for weeks and weeks to get them to talk to me, and they ultimately simply decided they were not going to comment for this show. They, I guess, as an institution, they don't want to be controversial, and or at least they don't want to court
criticized.
Well, perhaps, I don't know. For whatever reason, they wouldn't talk to me, but I'm so glad that you would. And so let's expand upon that a bit, if we may. Do you have any particular areas of agreement or disagreement with Senator Paul, as well as with his father, Ron Paul?
Well, I think Ron Paul, I know Ron Paul much better than I know his son.
Mm-hmm.
And I have debated him on radio years and years ago, back in the 1970s, when many of these issues were alive because of the inflation and unemployment problems that we had in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. I remember it well.
And I would end up my radio commentary to him to say, we don't have the gold standard. It isn't because we don't know about the gold standard. It's because we do. And, and I believe that's still true.
Anything else about Senator Paul's position, or excuse me, about Congressman Paul's position?
Well, I think Congressman Paul is really promoting a libertarian view. He ran, after all, once as a libertarian candidate for president. Now he's back in the Republican Party running as a Republican for president. He's spreading a lot of libertarian ideas, many of which I share, I can say, but not all of which I agree with. But I think that's a service. That is to present those views, to prevent the view that the Madison Constitution is a constitution of limited powers. Madison, as you know better than I'm sure, in the Federalist Papers, Madison says over and over again, this is not a grant of large authority and unlimited authority to a federal agent. This is a limited government with explicit powers. So, and Ron Paul is defending that position. I think that's an interesting point of view. He comes with a foreign policy which says that we should not be involved in so many countries. I think there is a problem, and I discuss it in my book, Why Capitalism, that President Eisenhower used to tell us we would not be the policemen of the world, but we became the policemen of the world. And the reason we became the policemen of the world is because we didn't have a rule which told us these are American interests, not always easy to define, but what we should be doing is pursuing American interests. Now, it's certainly true that if we don't do police action in the world, no one else will, and the world will be a more dangerous place. But the world is a dangerous place, and we are not in the position to be able to prevent all the bad things that happen around the world.
And that's our show today. I'd like to thank Professor Alan Meltzer of Carnegie Mellon University, who just did a fantastic job of explaining to us all these intricacies of the Federal Reserve and gold standard and the interest rate. I'd also like to thank United States Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky for giving us his input on both the constitutionality and the policies being followed by the Fed. If you're interested, you can, of course, listen to our show via podcast over iTunes. In fact, you might want to listen to this episode again, because believe me, there's lots of good stuff in here. And it's one of those episodes you might actually want to listen to more than once. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution and you need to learn about it.
The long-lost dollar has come back to the fold. With silver, you can turn your dreams to gold. Oh, we're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money. The sky is sunny. Old Man Depression, you are through. You done us wrong. Oh, we never see headline about red line today. And when we see the landlord, we can look that guy right in the eye. Oh, we're in the money. Come on, my honey. Let's lend it, spend it, send it rolling around.
Oh, boy, we're in the money.